From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Judge Neil Gorsuch, the man President Trump has chosen to fill the vacancy in the Supreme Court, is a Westerner, fourth-generation Coloradan, born in Denver, lives there now. And he's a skier. That could tell us something about him. In fact, Gorsuch has said that he was on a ski slope when he heard the news that Justice Antonin Scalia had died. The judge said he had to admit he cried his way down the mountain, which may also tell us something about how he thinks of the justice he's been chosen to replace. We're talking about Judge Gorsuch today. Is he an originalist like Scalia? And what do we know about where he stands on some of the issues that could face the court, like executive power, religious liberty, environmental regulations? Senator Orrin Hatch will also be among our guests today, and we invite you to join us after the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Whatever you think about Donald Trump's first acts as president, he certainly does seem to be keeping promises he made to conservatives. Throughout the campaign, he said he would quickly choose a nominee to replace Justice Antonin Scalia, who died a year ago. In fact, Trump said this was the most important promise that he made. And on Tuesday, he announced his pick. Judge Neil Gorsuch of the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. That's the district that includes parts of the Intermountain West. Utah's in the 10th Circuit. And Gorsuch himself is a Westerner. He spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C. when he was a kid, but he was born in Denver, lives in rural Colorado now. And today in the program, we're going to be talking about Judge Gorsuch, what we know about his life and judicial philosophy, where he may fit in the balance of power on the court, and, of course, what he's revealed about issues like religious liberty and executive power. Now, when you're talking about the Supreme Court, of course, you have to talk about politics. So we begin this morning with Utah Senator Orrin Hatch, who is on the Judiciary Committee in the Senate. He joined us earlier this morning from Washington, and he said that Gorsuch was an ideal choice for the court because he has abided by a principle extremely important to the senator, judicial restraint.
That's what we have the Congress for and the presidency for. The president can issue executive orders, and Congress really has the obligation of passing or not passing the laws. The courts are supposed to interpret the laws, not make them. And Gorsuch is a perfect illustration of somebody who is willing to interpret the laws but not make them and not act as a super legislator on the bench. Of all the people, all the judges in this country, the president couldn't have picked a better person.
I wondered, where do you think he fits? There were, I know that Judge Hardiman was on the list. Judge Pryor was also on the list. Where do you think Judge Gorsuch fits in the scheme of things? Some are saying somewhere in the middle, maybe.
No, he's basically a very solid constitutionalist, and he understands the role of judges is not to make the laws, but interpret the laws, and he's a hard worker. He's collegial. He gets along well with his fellow judges. He's been a terrific appellate judge in this country already. The Democrats don't like him because he's basically conservative. But as conservative as he is, he will uphold the law even if he doesn't, even if he has different opinions. He's the kind of guy that will do what is right no matter what, no matter what his own personal predilections are. You couldn't pick a better person to really abide by the rules and abide by the laws of judging. He's a terrific choice, I'll tell you. You know, the Democrats don't like him because he's conservative. Yeah. But, you know, that's I guarantee you, if they had won this last election and Hillary was president, they'd have picked the most liberal person they could possibly find.
So what are you expecting, Senator, from the process? I mean, these are pretty petty days politically, a lot of division. I expect you're expecting some maneuvering by your Democratic colleagues?
Well, we'll have to have hearings. It'll take a while to get to that. And I think you'll see a lot of maneuvering on the part of Democrats. Naturally, they would have preferred having a liberal person who's pro-abortion and all the things that conservatives are against. But, you know, when Trump won the election, it meant that he would be able to pick whoever he wanted.
You were pretty frustrated with your Democratic colleagues the other day when they boycotted committee hearings. You said it was a breach of decorum, and you even called some of them idiots. Do you still feel that way?
Yeah, I do. but they know I care for them, and I talked to the ranking member yesterday and said, look, that was a stupid thing to do, you guys. 2 days in a row, they refused to even come to the meeting. Well, you know, you reach a point where you have to say, hey, this is not good, and we've got to do what, under the rules, what we can do, and we did that. And now these two excellent nominees are going to be heard on the floor. Now, I imagine they'll raise a hullabaloo on the floor, but okay, we can live with that.
Yeah.
That's part of what being a U.S. senator is. But
yeah.
they were abnegating their responsibilities, and, you know, and doing it in a really, really terrible way. While we were sitting there waiting to begin, they're down the hall holding a press conference on why they didn't like the nominee.
Yeah, you suspended the rule for that morning. It was, of course, approved by the Senate parliamentarian, but it was a kind of a rare move. Are you expecting to have to do this kind of thing again?
Well, I hope not. I hope that they'll be reasonable about it. You know, we'll have a reasonable time for pouting and finding fault, but there comes a time when you have to do the job. You have to do the work. You know, they have a right to filibuster if they wanted to come to committee and so forth. And we have a right to shut that off. So, you know, I've always treated them fairly. They know it. That's why they didn't have anything to say about it yesterday, because they know it.
Yeah.
And I've given them extra time. I allowed them to dominate the hearing in a very large sense, knowing that if I didn't, they'd be crying about that. So,
Senator,
I'm not in a good position.
Right. I wanted to ask you, where are you on the matter of changing the rules of the Senate? The president said yesterday that Majority Leader McConnell should consider the so-called nuclear option. And I want to get this quote right. He said to reporters at the White House yesterday, if we end up with the same gridlock we've had in Washington for longer than 8 years, I would say, if you can, Mitch, go nuclear. What do you think about that?
Well, I think you ought to be very slow to want to use the nuclear option. But it's there. The Democrats are the ones who established it being there, and they used it. And I would say, I would hope that there'll be cooler heads over there who will vote, at least vote on the Senate floor, right or wrong, vote on these matters. Yeah, but if they don't, we have to move ahead, regardless of whether they're going to do their job or not.
Are there any particular issues or cases, Senator, that you're concerned about right now? You've mentioned religious freedom. As you're thinking about this new nominee and this process, what are the issues that come to mind right now?
Well, always at the top of the list is religious liberty, religious freedom to me. The First Amendment, in other words, and the Second Amendment, too. All the amendments are important, but those two are particularly important if we're going to have a civilized society. And, you know, it's no secret that Harry Reid and the Democrats wanted to change the First Amendment. Hillary Clinton said that she would have changed the First Amendment. Well, my gosh, why would we change the most important amendment in the Constitution? And, you know, but it shows how wild they are and how off the reservation they'll go just to have more power and more control. Well, that's one thing the Constitution does, is it kind of gives both sides, or all sides, a right to have some power and not to be rolled over and just treated like idiots. And the Constitution, if we follow it, we'll always have a strong, viable, wonderful country. If we don't follow it and we keep ignoring it and we try to amend it with frivolous amendments like that, we'll lose the freedoms that we currently cherish in every way.
You met with Judge Gorsuch yesterday. Was that mostly a formality, or were there things you wanted to know from him, or maybe even counsel him in terms of how the process gets underway?
I had quite a bit of time with him yesterday and the whole White House staff. And, I asked him a lot of questions and talked to him about a lot of things, and made it clear I want him to come visit me in my office, which he will do. And, mainly I want to make sure that he understands these people and he understands what he's got to do and what he's got to go through, and that he prepares properly there's no question in my mind he'll do all of those things, and he didn't need my advice to do it. But you just do worry about these things, and you mention them so that sometimes nominees get so harassed that they forget some of the salient things that they need to know.
Senator, we only have a minute or so left. Let me ask you finally. You referred to 2013 when Democrats changed the filibuster rule for the confirmation process of cabinet positions and federal judgeships. And you were pretty upset at the time. In fact, you said, let me get this quote right. You said, there's a price that has to be paid when people abuse the rules. These guys have completely obliterated the rules. So that must be on your mind as you consider whether or not you and your colleagues on the in the Republican Party would suspend the rules of filibustering. As you said earlier, it's something you're reluctant to do. But what do you think about that finally?
Well, the suspension of the rules is part of the rules. I mean, it provides for the ability to suspend the rules if you can't get things moving and going ahead. So the rules are important. They're important that we abide by them, and it shouldn't be abide by them in one way for the Democrats and not in a good way with the Republicans. It ought to be that we treat both sides fairly and significantly and that we abide by the rules in the best interest of our country. But I've got to say, what they were doing, it was beyond the pale. I mean, to do it one day, I didn't raise a fuss about it. But to then do it the second day after I gave notice and so forth, and just not even show up, and make it very clear they're not going to, they're not going to do their duty, they're not going to do their job. I couldn't let them get away with that. And people all over the Senate are really happy that we did what we did.
That's Utah Senator Orrin Hatch. Senator, thank you so much for the time.
Well, nice to spend time with you.
Utah Senator Orrin Hatch. Again, we are going to take a break and come back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Judge Neil Gorsuch, President Trump's choice to fill the vacancy in the Supreme Court. I mentioned he's a Westerner, born in Denver, lives in Colorado. We're going to talk about whether or not that means anything with University of Utah law professors Amy Wildermuth and Rennell Anderson-Jones. They've been paying attention to the high court. We're not just going to talk about the West. We'll also talk about legal philosophy and those other things. Let me introduce them properly. Amy Wildermuth is a professor of law at the University of Utah, clerked for Justice John Paul Stevens. Her work focuses on the Supreme Court and on administrative law. Good thing you focus on administrative law. We'll talk a little bit about that. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
Rennell Anderson-Jones, law professor also here at the university, clerked for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, writes about media and the Supreme Court. And Professor, welcome to you.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
I guess let's begin with how important is this nomination for conservatives? Professor Anderson-Jones, you've pointed out even people who weren't crazy about Trump's persona, didn't like his brashness, didn't like whatever it was about him, they sort of held their nose because this Supreme Court thing was a big deal.
It was. The polls in this area, the data is really overpowering that people who cared about the Supreme Court voted for Trump. And it was a motivator for a lot of people who were otherwise sort of holding their nose about certain policies or certain personality features that they didn't care for. I think that is true nationwide. I think it might be particularly true here in Utah. So I think it's interesting to us as Utahns.
Did it go the other way, though, for liberals? Did they turn out with concern?
Seem that it was as the data suggests that it wasn't as strong a motivator for Clinton voters as it was for Trump voters, and they galvanized people to do this. In fact, even just the nomination itself, we had been told it would happen sometime this month. Then a couple of weeks ago, we were told it would probably happen Thursday of this week, and then it got moved up. Right in the wake of things like the controversy over who would pay for the wall and the rollout of of some of the travel ban issues. And people on both sides of the aisle have been saying, right, it was deliberate to sort of remind,
a reminder at least, right? That's a cynical way to put it.
Yeah, to reinvigorate those social conservatives and those religious voters to say, here's why you picked me. I can be counted on to keep promises that you care about. And Neil Gorsuch is one of those.
Professor Wildermuth, does this give us any sense of where Donald Trump may be ideologically? Does this tip his hand in that way, or is this kind of a political maneuver like they often are?
I think it would be hard to read in ideology in terms of a nomination. And I think that's probably true of many presidents. I think there's maybe one dividing line in terms of sort of where people end up on judicial nominees. But in this instance, I mean, we have something that I think is relatively unprecedented. He ran and said, here are the 21 names of people that I will put on the Supreme Court. You just don't see that every day. I mean, that's a pretty rare occurrence. So when people went to the polls, if you were voting and you're a Republican, you knew the slate.
Yeah.
There was no similar slate on the other side. So it doesn't seem to have been as big a factor. And I think this was all... it appeared to be, you know, a compromise. There were many folks who were sort of on the fence about endorsing Trump, if we recall, during the campaign. And once he released that list, he was able to get more support from sort of political insiders in the Republican Party. So that would suggest that there was quite a bit of strategy around this.
It seems like you could say it's a pretty smart strategy. Judge Gorsuch for the Supreme Court. You had, and we should talk about whether or not there was kind of a deal in the works where Gorsuch fits in relation to others. Let me mention two others anyway, because three sort of emerged as the top. Third Circuit Judge Thomas Hardiman seemed like a fairly reliable conservative, had strong rulings for gun rights and liberal law enforcement practices, but seemed... Some conservatives seemed concerned. I read a couple of pieces that he might be a suitor. Mm. Like, wasn't a reliable conservative, okay? And then you had William Pryor from the 11th Circuit, described as a outspoken conservative. And I think that may be understating it. Really strong opinions on abortion rights, gay rights, very much opposed to same-sex marriage, for example, and Roe versus Wade. Is Gorsuch in the middle of those three? Where do you situate him?
That's a really interesting question. So right now, what we have to make sure everybody understands is that we are on one end of a spectrum and we are dividing people.
Right,
we are parsing them on that end of the spectrum. So let's make no bones
different
about
gradients
this.
Of right? conservative,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, all of these folks are the kind, they look at the law in a very particular way. So we are really talking about very fine distinctions at this point in terms of what we might expect from their judicial philosophy. I guess I would approach the question slightly differently. I think one of the things that is remarkable about Judge Gorsuch is that when you hear people talking about him who know him personally, and let's remember, he is a Washington insider. He had spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C., yeah. So he has many, many connections to many folks on both sides of the aisle.
Mother, and, very well connected.
Right.
And played a role in the Reagan administration. we'll get back to
and
that.
And that's a really complicated story. But I would say here, you know, he is well known and he is well respected. There are many, many people, and you see this in all the articles coming forward and saying, this guy is really, really smart. Mm-hmm. He's a great writer. He's shown that he's a good jurist. It would be, you know, I may disagree with him. But in that sense, the choice really is brilliant in that you have this sort of consensus of support.
Yeah.
Whether you agree with him or not, that's a different question.
Right.
So he's certainly very well qualified for the job.
Which kind of raises the I didn't want to get to politics quite yet, but I guess we have to ask the question about how Democrats are going to be dealing with this pick. Mm-hmm. If it were Pryor, who was really outspoken, it may have been another matter. Even though Gorsuch is a reliable conservative, is it going to be difficult for Democrats to oppose him?
So I think it might be. And I think that we should just put out on the table that the odds that Judge Gorsuch becomes a justice of the United States Supreme Court are incredibly high, right? A lot of the question is what the gamesmanship is going to be between now and then, but it's very, very likely that he takes his seat as a justice, probably by the time, at least by the time that the October term begins this year. I think it's unlikely he takes the seat by the in time to participate in this term.
Huh.
I mean, there were 80 plus days between the naming of the nominee and the confirmation of the nominee in most of the recent, even less contentious Supreme Court nomination processes. So it seems likely the last oral argument this term is in late April. So we really don't even have the 80 days, even if we got started right away. And there will be some obstructionism. So I think he doesn't participate this term. But I'm guessing the absent some really amazing discovery that people don't know about, or some skeleton in a closet, or some strategy that I have not thought of on the part of the Democrats. I think he takes the seat. So the question is just what sort of parliamentary battle happens in between, and how the senators on the Democratic side of things strategize what they need to be doing to preserve their progressive base.
I don't think we need to point out that that Justice Scalia died a year ago. President Obama was president, should have been his right to, and in fact he did, and we all of course know that part of the story, but I wonder how much of that, this idea that this is a stolen seat, that Republicans would not act on the nomination of Merrick Garland, how much of that is going to play out in this story?
So we already see it playing out.
Yeah.
There's sort of two ways that you see senators responding. One way they respond is they say, you wouldn't give an up or down vote, but I demanded an up or down vote, and so we give an up or down vote.
Yeah.
That's the way we need to do this in order for me to be consistent. The other one is sort of the, you know, throwing sand in the sandbox. Well, you delayed ours, we'll delay yours, right? So it just depends. And you see lots of senators trying to figure out where they want to be on that side of the fence. I have to say, you know, one of the political considerations is whether you spend all your time and energy on this particular nomination or whether you're waiting for the next one. And that's the real question at this point. Because remember that we're talking about the replacement for Justice Scalia. We are not talking about somebody who's going to change the current composition or the, you know, sort of old composition of the court. I think, right, you have to think about, if you're on the Democratic side of this, right, when is the time to really unload, if you will?
Yeah.
And I think that's a really careful calculation. Again, brilliant pick in the sense that it would be really hard to nitpick on his record. Outside of the fact, again, that he is a conservative.
Yeah.
And barring some, you know, skeleton in the closet that, you know, is discovered, he looks very, very good. So I think that's the calculation right now, is whether Democrats are going to decide this is the one that we go die on the hill for, or we wait for the next one.
Doesn't it seem like Democratic constituencies are going to expect some kind of pushback, though? Asking Democrats to, and I've heard it put colloquially this way, get a spine.
I think there is a lot of pushback from progressives in this country on this question. They are bitterly wounded that Obama's candidate nominee did not even get a hearing, right? Didn't even get the opportunity to move forward for an up or down vote. That many of them are using this word stolen about the seat that Article 2 of the Constitution says that the president nominates, and he was the president. And they point out that other justices, including Justice Kennedy, for example, who was a Republican nominee, was confirmed in his nominating presidents last year, right? And so I think that there is some anxiety amongst some in the Democratic base that they can't afford to be, you know, temperate when the opposing side has pulled out all the guns. Now, of course, the argument goes in both directions, right?
We heard from Senator Hatch
in the lead-in here. Chuck Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader, is going to insist, I think, that there be the 60 votes that are needed to overcome the filibuster, and that's going to push all the buttons on the nuclear option, the so-called nuclear option, which is that they can change the parliamentary rules to say that filibuster doesn't exist anymore, and now we can just do a simple majority vote. And Democrats did do this. Yep. They did exercise this this so-called nuclear option, but only as to lower court judges.
Not to the Supreme Court.
It has never, ever happened at the Supreme Court, and all of President Obama's nominees had 60-plus votes. So and Mitch McConnell condemned that tactic,
yeah, he
that he might now expand.
So did Hatch. So did Lindsey Graham. And they were all talked about how – in fact, what was it? This is something I meant to actually talk to the senator about. Senator Graham said this. He said this was in 2013. When Democrats did away with the filibuster for these cabinet positions and federal judgeships, he said, I don't think I've ever felt any worse about the institution than I do today. Hatch himself said that they had obliterated the rule, which I sort of read that to him. Senator McCain said by taking away the filibuster that Democrats broke the rules and they violated everything I've known as a member. So these guys seem to feel really strongly about this rule. How will they feel when it helps there?
That's right. And conversely, Democrats spent most of last year saying that it was a travesty for the Supreme Court to be stuck at 8 members, that 9 is obviously a better number, right, because it doesn't divide evenly, which means we get outcomes and we get uniformity of the rule of law throughout the nation. It seems that at least some of them are now going to be backing themselves into a corner on that question because they're suggesting one tactic might be that keep this seat empty, right? We filibuster for as long as we can until maybe there's a second nominee and then we force some kind of compromise. Not moving forward to fill a seat that has now been empty for coming up on a calendar year pushes back against their suggestion that 8 is a terrible number. So we see your preference obviously differs depending on whether your ideological guy is in your corner. But it does seem that we ought to be concerned overall about this risk that the process has become so much more partisan. And we may well be, you know, inching towards this really terrible state of affairs where only a party that controls both the executive branch and the Senate could actually move forward on judges. And that's that would be a new state of affairs and I think an unhealthy one.
Okay, let's set aside politics for a minute. Let's talk about judicial philosophy. And this is important, I know, to both of you. Is Gorsuch qualified?
Yes.
I mean, that's pretty simple, right? Seems to be no question about that.
We've both said that.
Yeah. You've talked about the importance of getting good legal minds on the court. Whether you agree with his conclusions, you both think that's his reasoning, his mind, his writing, all of that seems pretty great.
Correct. I mean, I think that the court, again, is a place where we make really important decisions. And in my view, that is best done when people reflect multiple ideologies and bring multiple things to the table. It does not do – it does a great disservice, in other words, to have decision-making made, you know, done by just people who all agree with each other. All the research actually indicates that that's, in fact, true. You get better outcomes when people disagree.
Yeah.
So I think on that front, it's very easy to say – that he is going to add something to the Supreme Court. Again, not a change. I don't think this is a huge change from what we saw with Justice Scalia, although we probably should do a little bit better job to respect that he is going to be a new person. He will not be Justice Scalia on the court. He will be his own kind of jurist. It's just there are some similarities. Let me also go ahead and say this about
the nomination. Like the principal similarity, forgive me. It seems like the principal similarity is that he's an originalist like Scalia.
Yes.
And a decent writer, although not quite the flair that Scalia seems to
have. I would say he's a better
he's
than
a great
decent
writer.
Wow, he's an excellent writer.
He's an entertaining writer. Yeah. So he writes, his judicial opinions are written with this flair, an accessibility, which is something similar to what Scalia was sort of known for, is his opinions, even when you really, really disagree with where they are headed and where they land, you enjoy the moment of reading them because he was very vivid and had this kind of vitality, this narrative storytelling style. And Neil Gorsuch has that same gift. It's one of the, he's a judge's judge in many ways, but he's also a very accessible writer.
He uses terms like argle bargle.
Well, Justice Scalia was known for being so excited about his opinions. He would have all his clerks gather and he would read them, right? I mean, you get that same feel when you read a Gorsuch opinion. Again, you may disagree with the outcome, but they are very, very well done. I don't think that's something that you can criticize.
One thing we might also emphasize is that Justice Scalia's vivid opinions were a little bit different than Judge Gorsuch's in terms of their, I guess I'm going to use the word temperament. They're very similar ideologically, both originalists, both textualists, both very hesitant about looking into the spirit of the law or the Constitution, but rather to its text and its original meaning.
Yeah.
Both are led to by those judicial philosophies to conservative outcomes. Justice Scalia was sort of biting and combative.
Seething.
He had this kind of caustic approach. Right. He was one of the first justices on the court to stop using the term "I respectfully dissent" at the end of his opinions and just say "I dissent," right? And often took barbs at his colleagues in ways that people didn't really appreciate and didn't think was great for the integrity of the institution. Judge Gorsuch, by all accounts, has a very different personality. He's mild and courteous and well-liked, and people have this sort of affection for him. So I think we'll see interesting writing, but it might not be with the same tone that we saw from Justice Scalia.
You definitely don't find those angry opinions in what Gorsuch has done so far. And no one has reported anything like that temperament.
Yeah. I distracted you. I think where you were headed was the distinction between, maybe that's where you were headed, the distinction between Gorsuch and Scalia. It seems like you've suggested, Professor, that he's maybe more aligned with a Roberts than a Scalia.
I think it's possible. I mean, we're splitting hairs, right? Yeah. These are shades of difference. No one is a perfect replacement for the person that preceded them, right? There's no sort of robot that's going to come in and do exactly the same thing. The temperament is different. There's certainly stylistically different things. Here's another thing that I really want to get out on the table, and that is we finally have a Westerner on the court.
Yeah.
I mean, this has been a place where we've had those from the East Coast really predominating who is on the court. Now, in fairness, Justice Kennedy is from California.
That's not the West.
He's from Sacramento.
It might count. It's more the West than San Francisco
or L.A. is. And he was a sort of solo practitioner in Sacramento. So I think he has some Western mentality to him. But the point is fair that it is largely an East Coast elite institution.
Okay, but Gorsuch lives in rural Boulder County, has horses.
Has chickens and goats.
He's a black diamond skier. He fly fishes. I think, what do you think is significant about that, though? Just beyond the fact that just sheer geographic diversity, would that imbue his opinions or his ideas with something different?
I would say yes. I think that changes your perspective. And I think his experience on the Tenth Circuit in particular is so very different than the sort of docket you would see on the Second Circuit or the First Circuit, you know, the East Coast.
Or especially the D.C. Circuit, which is right there inside Washington, where a lot of justices have sprung from that circuit in recent years.
And we can think about what the differences might be. We would have public lands cases. He's going to have a lot more experience with things involving Native Americans. I mean, there's a whole list of things that we in the West take for granted, like water rights, just not an issue on the East Coast. So these are things that he is culturally, you know, more aware of because of his perspective as a Westerner.
Okay, so this brings up, at least to me anyway, the potential influence of his mother, Ann Gorsuch, who worked with the transition team, for example, in the Reagan administration, very much sort of in the team with the Reagans, and was the EPA administrator. And in her time there, she really advocated this approach of downsizing federal agencies and delegating their functions and their services to the states. Now, what's one of the principal issues in Utah right now? The question of federal land and whether the states could manage it. And I'm wondering, could that come up, and would this have any effect? I mean, it's hard to sort of see forward, but I'm wondering what you think about that.
Sure. States' rights are always on the docket, right? Even when they're not explicitly on the docket, they are the undercurrent of a lot of interpretation of various constitutional doctrines like the Dormant Commerce Clause or various questions about the scope and reach of congressional authority. The justice for whom I clerked, Sandra Day O'Connor, was a Westerner, born and raised on a sprawling ranch in Arizona. And she repeatedly said publicly that she self-identified as a Westerner on the court, that her role of sort of bringing this geographic diversity mattered. And this issue of states' rights was one of the places where she thought it mattered, that Western states had more of these conflicts in real time between the federal government and what power is reserved for the state decision making. And I think that she thought of that as very important, that she brought a voice to the table that was important. I think your point about his mom and about Anne Burford's short and, we should say, I think, rocky tenure as the head of the EPA also points out that he is Gorsuch is a really diverse nominee, except that he isn't, right? So he brings this geographic diversity, but in many respects, he's also really straight out of central casting, right? The guy comes from this important Washington, D.C. family with loads of political connections. He went to top schools. Yeah. He went to a preparatory school in D.C. He had two elite Supreme Court clerkships and worked for an elite D.C. firm and the DOJ.
Harvard, Oxford.
He went to Harvard with – he was in the graduating class with Barack
President
Obama.
Obama.
Went to Columbia for undergrad. So especially compared to this list that Amy spoke of at the top of the show of – possible Trump nominees, many of whom had very different life stories. People who had, were the first people in their family to go to college, or who had gone to schools that were not Ivy League schools, or who were from circuits that didn't have that much power, or are thought of as sort of ignored. Gorsuch is the most insider of the outsiders on that list, I think.
You pointed this out that, and this seems odd to say diversity, but is he the only Protestant?
Yes.
Would he be the only Protestant on the court?
Yes. They are all either Catholic or Jewish.
Yeah.
Correct.
O'Connor is Episcopalian.
Right.
And so during her time on the court.
And Justice Stevens.
That's right. But they are both gone now. And so we are down to 5 Catholics and 3 Jews.
And we don't say gone. We say retired.
That's right.
So they are still gone from the building. They are still with us. Yes. If there's just one small point that I would like to correct for folks out there, we continue to say that he had 2 Supreme Court clerkships. Yeah. I want to make sure that we're very clear about this. Supreme Court clerks, there in some instances, do clerk for 2 justices, clerk for 2 terms. That was not Judge Gorsuch's path. He was hired by Justice Byron White. Another one.
Colorado.
Colorado. And he was shared, as retired justices can have 1 clerk, he then gets shared with another chambers, and that happened to be Justice Kennedy. So he was only there for 1 term. But it's just technically those folks that are clerking for a retired justice don't have as much to do,
right.
And so they are then shared with a different chambers, and that's how we ended up with working with Justice
and
Kennedy.
And the fact that the justice was Kennedy might matter to us as we look forward.
It's a good segue to talk about this part of it, because you're hearing that it may be another part of the sort of calculus that President Trump was going for, that if he was able to pick someone that Anthony Kennedy trusted or liked, that it may prod him – Kennedy is, after all, 80 – to retire. What do you make of that?
No.
No, you're not buying that
I have to say, my view of justices is that there's a lot of things we can say about Article III judges and people on the Supreme Court. Really, to my mind, display this, and that is nobody tells them what to do.
Right.
And so, I just think that this is it is a misunderstanding of how Justice Kennedy might do his calculation here. Mm. He's a different kind of justice. He's certainly not like Justice Stevens or Justice O'Connor. But I will be very clear in saying to anyone who asks, right, Justice Stevens didn't have an exit plan. There was never any sort of, oh, I should have retired because now
Clinton or Gore lost, or, there was never any kind of calculation like that. It was much more of, do I like doing this job? Do I want to keep doing this job? And many of them do it for a very long time.
Yeah.
So the political calculus here is a tricky and complicated one. Now, also remember that Justice Stevens wasn't really politically motivated when he was doing all kinds of things at the court. So he may not be a reflection of exactly what Justice Kennedy is thinking,
but
I don't know if he's an outlier, but I just think that we have to be very careful in thinking about how justices might think about their legacy and what they want to accomplish on the court.
I think it's important, though, to recognize that this discussion about Neil Gorsuch is important not because of the seat he's replacing, but because of the possibility of a second seat that he will replace. Right? He restores the court to the position that it was in during the time that Scalia was there from 2006 until last year, which was a conservative-leaning court, but with an ardent swing vote, yeah. who is
Kennedy.
Justice Kennedy.
Yeah.
And Justice Kennedy has sided with the liberal branch of the court in some really key sort of social issue kinds of cases. He was the author of the Obergefell case on gay marriage, and he has been with them on abortion, importantly. And so his departure is not an ordinary Republican appointee departure, and his replacement by a Trump administration is not an ordinary replacement. It would, in fact, shift the balance of the court in a really significant way. And Kennedy is, as you said, 80. Justice Ginsburg and Justice Breyer, who are both liberal Democratic appointees.
She's 83.
83 and he's 78. Yeah. They'll both be in their mid or late 80s by the end of a four-year term and into their 90s in some instances if there was an eight-year term. So I think it is important. I think people are watching. I'm not saying whether Kennedy is watching or isn't watching, although I do think he cares about his legacy. And I think he has decided to be a swing vote for a reason, because he is ideologically to the left of Judge Gorsuch, and certainly to the left of Justice Scalia, whose seat was vacated. And so there is some sensitivity, and there was, I think, some there were a lot of eyes on this nomination to see if it would be an ideologically extreme or inflammatory nomination, in part because people are trying to read the tea leaves about what might come next.
Let's take a break, and then I want to get to some particular issues that you may perceive as the way, potentially could happen now with this new makeup, assuming he does get nominated. I think you're right. The chances are pretty good. Who knows? Ronnell Anderson-Jones, law professor at the University of Utah, is with us, and Amy Wildermuth, also professor of law here at the University of Utah. We'll take a quick break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Judge Neil Gorsuch. Of course, is President Trump's choice to fill the vacancy in the Supreme Court. We're talking with Ronnell Anderson-Jones, teaches law at the University of Utah. So does Amy Wildermuth. They're both here in the studio. Okay, where is Gorsuch on the question of religious liberty? We know that he voted for the so-called Hobby Lobby case. This is requiring small businesses to provide contraception. That the federal law that said small businesses have to provide contraception, that violated laws protecting religious freedom. So we know that. But this was interesting, too. It's also been pointed out that Gorsuch wanted that ruling to go further, not just extend to businesses, but to people, to individuals. Here's what he wrote. He said, "All of us face the problem of complicity. All of us must answer for ourselves whether and to what degree we're willing to be involved in the wrongdoing of others. For some, religion provides an essential source of guidance both about what constitutes wrongful conduct and the degree to which those who assist others in committing wrongful conduct themselves bear moral culpability." Like, that's pretty strong. And it seems to indicate that if you have a case that comes to the high court, bakers who don't want to make cakes for same-sex couples or whatever it might be, you can go down the list, he might be sympathetic.
I think that's right. I think that is actually as good an explanation as any for why he moved to the top of the shortlist for Trump's nomination. He is questionably, and with a judicial record, an ardent defender of religious liberties, which is the contours of the promise that Trump made, siding with these employers who had these religious objections to providing contraception, for example, to employees. That's the Hobby Lobby case, but also the Little Sisters of the Poor case.
Right, right.
Both of those cases he was involved in. He was involved in other cases, the case that sprang out of Utah involving the public display of the Ten Commandments and these sort of public displays of religion. And I think that you're right that people are assuming from some of this judicial record, they're filling in gaps about other hot topics that might come before the court for which we don't have a judicial record. So we don't have any LGBTQ cases or gay rights cases that he authored, but we might fill in the gaps and say in an instance in which, say, you know, the cake decorator or the flower provider is asserting a religious liberty on one hand and gay rights are asserted on the other hand, that he's already shown us where he might fall. The same is true on abortion, which was a very big hot topic. I mean, Trump repeatedly said out loud as a candidate, I will pick someone who will overturn Roe.
Yeah.
We don't have any judicial record on the abortion front from Judge Gorsuch, but we do have this sort of inclination to be in favor of positions taken by the religious right. And we also have a body of material. He's written a book and also a number of articles on questions involving things like assisted suicide, where he's taken very strong positions about the sort of sanctity of human life, and you sort of take one step from that and you might imagine that he would be in a position to be scaling back abortion rights if that case came to the court.
Now, of course, in that same interview with Trump, I think it was on 60 Minutes, and he said, you know, I'm looking for somebody who's going to overrule Roe v. Wade. He said there were things that you couldn't do, and that would be overruling, apparently, all of the gay marriage cases that are much more recent. So I'm not sure if there is consistency here. But I think it's fair to say that a certain judicial philosophy and a certain way of reading the Constitution is going to get you to certain answers. And that makes it a little easier to predict exactly where things may come out. Because Judge Gorsuch has been so clear in sort of how he is going to work through problems, we do know probably more of the answers than we might know in other instances where nominees don't have that kind of record.
If you've written a book or if you've made comments like the one I just read, how does it work in a confirmation hearing if you're trying to keep that away from
senators? Confirmation hearings are really tricky, right? Because there are things that we as the public want to know, and there are things that senators as members of the Senate Judiciary Committee want to know. But we also don't...
Even though they never get an answer.
That's right. Well, and part of the reason that they don't get a straight answer on some of these questions is that we don't wish to put nominees in a position where they would have to recuse themselves from the participation in the actual case that came up because they had prejudged it sitting there in front of a panel of senators.
Right.
So they're trying to walk this sort of careful line where you ask questions about judicial philosophy or about your approach or about, as you said, things that you have written,
yeah.
Right? Tell us about this thing that you've already written and these positions that you've already taken.
But and then you say a version of, I'm just calling balls or strikes.
Correct.
Justice Roberts. Yeah. Brilliant.
But I think that the other thing we have to insert here, though, is that one of the downsides to the sort of modern confirmation process, particularly at the Supreme Court, is that it is helpful, shall we say, to not have a record. And to me, that's actually a great disservice to all of us. So you shouldn't want to have nominees that are so careful in what they've done that you actually don't know anything about them because they've been preparing for this moment all their lives. I think that's a terrible step. So I don't think that people should be sort of held back because they've expressed these various views. But that certainly is the state of play today.
Yeah. In fact, he, Judge Gorsuch himself, in the early 2000s, wrote a law review article in which he sort of bemoaned how grossly mistreated some are in confirmation proceedings. He was referencing, in fact, interestingly enough, Merrick Garland.
Wow.
Recent Merrick Garland, obviously.
No,
the initial.
And also John Roberts.
And John Roberts. Yeah. So So he chose two examples from across the aisle to say people are treated in this scathing way that might deter people, good people, strong lawyers, the best minds in the country from coming forward to do this. And now he finds himself in that exact position.
We're running out of time. I want to get to where you think Judge Gorsuch, what he's thinking about executive power and administrative law. This is your bailiwick. What do you think?
It is mine. I think more surprising jurisprudence that has come from Judge Gorsuch, and he got a lot of media attention for this, is a decision in which he questioned Chevron, which is a doctrine that gives lots and lots of deference to executive agencies interpreting statutes. This has been, as I have written, right, one of the things that people are really looking at right now, particularly on the conservative side. So there's the extreme version of this, which is that the sort of executive agency, the administrative state, is entirely unconstitutional. That is not, as I understand it, Judge Gorsuch's position.
And was it Scalia's position?
It was not at all Scalia.
He was turning, right?
Gorsuch is to the right of Scalia on this, if we think of it as the right.
Unless you think that Justice Scalia, and many do, believe he was on a trajectory to do what Judge Gorsuch has suggested. That is that in his private musings and then in some of his dissents, you see that Justice Scalia may have been headed in this direction. I had said before when we were on that we were going to see this no matter who was in the administration, that we are going to have big questions asked about deference doctrines and other doctrines that govern the administrative state. So he's certainly there. Now, again, this doesn't change the equation because many people predicted that Justice Scalia was going to be there as well.
And let's emphasize that this might feel part and parcel of the sort of anti-regulatory small government push of the Trump administration, but it might also serve to push back on the Trump administration, right? It would mean that the courts would themselves be Justice Gorsuch, if he comes to the court, would be more willing to second guess the determinations made by the administrative state under Trump.
Wow. Interesting.
And the solution is that Congress then has to do something to fix it, which is not what has been the existing way of doing things. So getting
you mean because they have a difficult time governing.
That would be exactly
that might
correct.
Be right.
And in my view, often just leave it to the administrative state to do and then blame them, but not really take action. So
less than 30 seconds. It sounds like you're not expecting this to whether it goes well or not, that you don't think that this judge will be seated during this term.
I just don't think it's possible. It's just not within the sort of time frame. So I think there's cases that are pending that haven't been scheduled for argument. I think they'll be pushed to the next term because they just will divide 4-4.
That's right. They'll see that they will have a full court coming down the line and might wait on some of those cases until that happens. But I'm guessing October.
Renell Anderson-Jones, law professor at the University of Utah. Amy Wildermuth, law professor at the University of Utah. Both, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.